Hi, everybody. My name is George Ellison. I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found it necessary to take a drink since October 26, 1966. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. Now, a few things. It is a good thing that George Backus isn't here when you messed up right out front. I'd much rather have Gracie coming up at me than George. And not that really I care. I'm a West Virginian by birth, but Myrtle Beach is in South Carolina. That might upset Strom Thurmond, but tonight it's sort of a special occasion to me, and you'll have to indulge me a little bit. I thought maybe that I'd try, since there was a lot of people out there that's heard me, that I might try to do something different. And last year, down in the South, I won't say where, there was a conference, and they had the singing cowboy. Sort of sang his lead and all that. And tonight I thought maybe that I'd present to you the handsome hillbilly. I'm not sure everybody got the full effect of that, but the people that are here from my home group will understand that. I am a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and very proud to be a member of that group. It is hard for me to look back to the end of that room where I spent many a year and not see George and Joe. Now that's for me. I happen to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who is very grateful for those who came before us. And some of you, years later, will probably be at a conference, and I hope it means as much to you when you start reminiscing and thinking about some of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that had carried the message to you and that had expressed love and help you in their sobriety. I'm not going to cry through this whole thing. I hope not. But because I'm going to get that out of the way quick. But there's a lot of people here. Nick, especially, because Nick was, I thought he was at the first Bluestone Conference, but he was at the second one, like I was. And he goes way back. And you heard last night a beautiful speaker. And she sort of owns that group down in Myrtle Beach. Some people accuse me of that, but that's not true. I only sleep with the owner. But sometimes it's a small world. It really is. Karen, who spoke this morning, she and Elmer were Marie and I's host at Cook's Forest several years ago. And if I really knew that Elmer had really been that bad to Karen, I'd be darned if I'd have stayed in the cabin with him. Tomorrow morning, there's a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous members here that might reminisce and go back, because it usually, years ago at the assemblies, it usually worked this way. I started talking and Bob ended talking. And Bob's going to speak tomorrow morning, and you're in for a real treat. Bob is a dear friend of mine, and we go way back. So I hope you understand it's going to be very hard for me to speak to a lot of these people in this crowd, because my sobriety goes back with these people, and I grew up with these people, and I am very grateful to a lot of these people, and some of them are gone. And I've been behind this podium before. and was, you know, had the honor, and it is always an honor for me to be able to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or function. But I had the honor to, you know, to present Millie to this crowd at Bluestone, and Isaac spoke here that same weekend, and some of these people mean a lot to me. And I'm just glad to be back. I'm glad to be in West Virginia, and I am a hillbilly by birth, and they tell me that I'm supposed to say in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today. And I was born in Charleston, West Virginia, and I don't think that there was anything real special about my childhood other than the fact that I was, I was born to a half-Christian home. I know a lot of people, Isaac wasn't even born in a Christian home, but I was born in a half-Christian home. My mother was a very fine Christian and a very, very, very spiritual woman. And my father was an alcoholic golfer. And that really didn't, I don't know that affected me too much in my early years. You know, I don't come from a dysfunctional family or, you know, all this stuff. But the way it affected me is that my mother, as far as I know, hasn't been to too many meetings of Al-Anon, but she lived with my father, the alcoholic, but somehow in her spiritual life, she always related to me that this man was a sick person. She never, that I ever heard of, said that you know, my father was a bad person, or that he was a mean person, or that he, you know, she somehow knew that he was a sick person, and that's what she always told me. And when I was growing up, she would say things like that he was a sick person. But she would follow that up with I hope you see what alcohol did to him or does to him, and that you won't do it. And until I was 13 years old, I didn't. You know, and I wasn't. And I didn't like alcohol, there was nothing. I don't like to say, you know, I don't say this in a bragging way, but when I was growing up as a kid, you know, until alcohol entered my life, you know, I had straight A's, and I was president of the National Junior Honor Society, and I was played football, and I was, you know, just one of those drippy kids that they all hate, you know, like Jack Armstrong or something. You know, I mean, I did everything right. You know, I was the paper boy, and everybody in the neighborhood loved me, and all this stuff, you know, and all that junk. And, you know, when I was 13 years old, I took a drink of alcohol, and that immediately changed, immediately. You know, I thought as soon as I took that first drink of alcohol that my mother was wrong, and my father was a pretty smart man. I realized right then why he drank liquor, because I loved it. And I was not one of those, and I'm not here to argue with anybody. I was not a person who crossed that thin line into alcoholism. You know, I immediately went into alcoholism. You know, I was born on this side of the line. You know, I took a drink of alcohol, and I got drunk the very first time I took a drink of alcohol, and I got drunk the very last time I took a drink of alcohol, and I got drunk every time in between that I took a drink of alcohol, because I thought that's what it was for. I wanted what it gave me. You know, I related to what Dr. Silkworth talks about. I liked the effect. I liked what it did for me. And I started drinking at that age, and things just immediately, you know, the grades went bad, and I quit playing football, and you know, who cares? Nobody got their newspaper on time, and you know, it was just very drastic change. But I loved it, and I continued to drink, and I really don't like to those who have heard me talk. I really don't like to get into a lot of drinking, because I think at least the alcoholics out there that are here this evening know how to drink, or they know how not to drink, or whatever it is that we do out there. What I like to really talk about is recovery, but I think, you know, I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous next to the state of Ohio, And in Ohio, where Alcoholics Anonymous was founded, you know, they're very big on the fact that you need to identify yourself as an alcoholic, you know, from the podium when you get up to talk. If you don't, they'll sort of ask you to leave. So I would like to tell you enough about my drinking and my alcoholism that there'll be no doubt in your mind. You know, I can I can tell you that as an alcoholic, I could relate to everything that Dr. Silkworth talks about. You know, as a when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful for that I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that was a traditional Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I say, and sometimes people come up and question me, or they want to know what I'm trying to say, and I hope I can express this to you, but I am a product of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm what the book is written about, an alcoholic. I got sober no other way than through the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think it's nice that we have other places and things out there that alcoholics go to, and I'm not against them. That's their business. But my recovery has been within the confines of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and within these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and was taught by people of Alcoholics Anonymous who carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's very, very important to me. You know, I'm not sure today that happens at all places in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, by a very loving sponsor and by a lot of very loving people in Williamstown, Marietta area, in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I was taught, that book writes and tells about us alcoholics and allows me to identify and to understand my disease, but it also gives me a solution, and the solution is a spiritual recovery. And then it gives me a recipe or directions to follow to bring about that spiritual recovery. And so when I walked in AA, I had a sponsor that I think a lot of people in this room know. He at one time was also a member of this conference committee, and a very dear man and a very loving man. And the way I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm a believer of the term that it talks about, that we don't promote people into Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is an attraction, and I was attracted. You see, this man in April of 1966 and I were on a drunk, and on a pretty extended drunk. We'd been away from home for a good amount of time and sort of met up with each other one morning and were trying to get well over at this little bar in Marietta, Ohio. And it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting there, and he was drinking gin and eating ice cream. Now, I was drinking gin, trying to get well, and you know, he said to me, George, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and God knows he needed to go. Anybody that would sit there and drink gin and eat ice cream, and you know, has got to be a very sick. I'm sure that's what Bill meant when he said real alcoholics. He went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and from April until September of 1966, what I did is I went home. I knew that I was having maybe a little problem with alcohol. You know, not real bad. Sort of, you know, just a little tiny problem, nothing that I couldn't handle, certainly. And what I did was I did everything that they talk about in Chapter 3 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I changed the brand that I drank. I drank when I was alone. I drank when I was with people. I did just everything I could do different. Everything turned out the same way that it always turned out. You know, I got drunk. And that summer, That summer, I started watching this man. In my drunken stupor, I started watching Guy get well. And I started seeing Guy get respect in the community, and I saw Guy get respect from his family, and I saw this man getting well physically, and I saw him doing and living like a human being should live. And I kept watching this. That's why I say I was attracted. In the meantime, there is some of you who know Guy, and you have to know that at times he can be a little sarcastic. And there was periods in this time that I went to Guy and I would say, "Do you think that I'm an alcoholic?" Now, these times were caused by little upheavals in my life, like getting out of jail and, you know, certain things that happen to us alcoholics that sometimes we question whether we, you know, may have a problem. And his answer was always the same, and thank God it was, you know, because, I mean, it worked for me. I didn't pick up the sarcasm at that point, but very sarcastically he would say to me, "No, George, you're doing real well. You're doing real good with this drinking. Don't worry at all whether, you know." I can remember that summer, I was on top of the Williamstown Bridge. I was going to commit suicide. Now, I was a suicidal alcoholic. I'd like to bring that out right out front because, you know, I just, you know, some of us do and some of us don't, but I was a suicidal alcoholic. Now, I wasn't real serious about it. You know, the way I envisioned, you know, committing suicide was like jumping in front of a parked car. I just didn't like the pain, you know. I mean, I guess if I could have done it without any pain, you know, it might have been all right. But so I got up on the Williamstown Bridge one night over the Great Ohio River, and I drew a crowd. I was going to jump, you know, and I had a crowd of people up there. It was about four or five people. Guy being one of these, you know, I had called him, or someone had called him and said that George was in the middle of the bridge, he's going to jump and whatever. Now, I wasn't getting too close to the rail because I didn't want to fall. But I always like to bring this out because I do believe that we alcoholics have a daily reprieve contention on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, and we may be out there, you know. And so if any of you are out there, I happen to take a drink and I'm back out there and I happen to be on a bridge, you'll know exactly what to say to me to get me off of this, because, you know, I would like to even phone this information to the crisis center. But what Guy said to me, he said, "George, let's go down to Murphy's Bar and Grill and have a drink and talk about it." Now, I beat him off the bridge. Somehow I felt like maybe this is what... This was what maybe my problem was, because I think I was out of money. But I watched this man, and in September of 1966, I called him through attraction. I was tired of living the way I was living. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I had reached the point in my life that I couldn't drink, and I couldn't quit drinking. And that's a tough place to be for any alcoholic. And my life was a shambles. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was nobody really left. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the court of last resort. I had been everywhere else for my drinking. I had been everywhere else for my problems. The point that my life was around me at this time was that my mother, who was a very fine spiritual woman, you know, had bailed me out time and time and time and time and time and time and time again. And she had disowned me. And my first wife, I like to say that. Marie is my last wife. We'll get that straight right now. So for right now, what I'm talking about is the first wife. Now, when we're talking about qualifications, as an alcoholic, I could stop here. Because all of you know now, when we start talking about wives, evidently we got an alcoholic up here, because we all seem to have multiple. Well, not all of us, but you know, a lot of us have multiple. But my first wife was leaving. My children were afraid of me. They were 5 and 6 years old at the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't have a friend that I could call on. I had run everybody pretty much off. Guy was the only one really left. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was the one I was watching. So I called him. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish that I could say right now that from that day, you know, I got on my white horse and I rode out in the sunset and everything was wonderful. You know, and someone yelled, "Hi-yo, Silver, who is that masked man?" or whatever they do, you know. But that's just not true. Because I was to drink again a month later. But some of the reasons I was to drink again, I think, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in September, you know, all of a sudden, after I got some days of sobriety, I started questioning. And I started, you know, Guy would be talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd say, "George, we take this thing a day at a time." And I wasn't buying that. You know, I said, I don't understand a day at a time. You know, I will probably never drink again in my life. You know, out of stone. And I had these visions of grandeur. You know, we alcoholics have that ego, and some of us don't get rid of it after so many years. You know, I think, at least I have a problem with that all the time. You know, I think it's something that alcoholics work on, or this alcoholic works on. But that ego was running wild. What I could envision. You know, even I had, 7, 8 days of sobriety. I wanted 40 years of sobriety. I knew at that time Bill Wilson probably had 25 years of sobriety. So I really didn't even want what he had. I wanted more. And I could vision myself 40 years sober with long, gray, flowing hair that sort of shoulder length, you know, that sort of just batted in the breeze. And, you know, I'd walk into meetings. I'd float into meetings, you know. And people sort of hang on to every word I said. And, you know, and this gets to be a real sickness with us alcoholics, you know. And so I just wasn't listening to anything. And I had no recovery. I hadn't worked on anything other than I just was at Alcoholics Anonymous. A month later, I went to Chicago on a convention. And I wasn't out of town 10 minutes. Or on my way to Chicago that I got drunk. And I stayed drunk 6, 7 days. And I think sometimes it's, you know, I always sometimes try to bypass this. You know, I try to get through this and get to recovery real quick. And sometimes we forget about miracles. And when I was in Chicago, I was drunk and I was calling Guy back on the phone. You know, telling him everything's fine. You know how we alcoholics are. You know, I called him several times in a blackout because I didn't remember even calling him. And, you know, describing the AA clubhouse to him, you know, in Chicago. You know, he's saying, "Is everything going fine, George? You're not drinking?" "Oh, no, I'm not drinking. No, I went to the club last night and we had a meeting and da, 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 da." I don't know where the clubhouse in Chicago is today. You know. But I told him an address and I, you know, described all this stuff to him. And I was trying to hide this, you know, from him. And on the sixth day, I could not. I was so much into the drinking now that I just couldn't stop. I couldn't get off of it. And I was in this big hotel in Chicago, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was dying for a drink. And you know, I understand when Wino Joe talks about the brown whimpers, because I've had the brown whimpers, you know, waiting for that liquor store to open. And I was waiting for this bar to open in the Hilton Hotel, and couldn't just, you know, I was just coming apart, and I decided that I wouldn't stand out in front of the bar waiting, that maybe I ought to go down on this convention floor. And it was a big convention, and it was in the business that I was in, and I walked into one of the booths, you know, where people were displaying product and just trying to kill time. and shaking and dying and wanting to drink it. And the first man that I walk into is a man who looks like, you know, he looked like Al Hurt. Great big man. And we started a conversation. We were just talking. And I told him I was from Marietta, Ohio, and he eventually said, do you know Al Kaufman? I said, yeah, I sure do. He said, is Al sober? Now, this is the only words that we started talking about. I mean, this man didn't know where I was coming from, but surely I don't think he knew. And I said, yes, he is sober. So then he looked at me and he said, how do you know? Well, I don't know about you, but when I'm drinking 6 days and I'm sort of waiting to get a drink, I get a little testy, you know. Especially when people start asking me questions I don't really want an answer, you know. I said, well, I went to a meeting with him last week. He said, oh, are you an Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, well, yes, by the way, I am. I said, but I had a little problem right now. I'm nipping a little bit. Well, you know, they talk about conning a drunk. You know how we always talk, you can't con a drunk. He looked at me and said, oh, you're nipping. I said, yes. And he said, well, do you want to get off of it? And I said, yeah, I would. I would like to. He said, well, you're going to stick with me. He said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I was Al's sponsor when he was in Akron, Ohio. And I said, okay. Well, that's 8 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know if you drunks can relate to it, but I was very sincere that day, right then. So I got with Bill, and we started to get, you know, we started on this road to sobriety. And a couple hours had gone by, and Bill said, everything going all right? I said, oh, yeah. Another hour goes by, and I'm wanting to drink so bad I can't stand it. And I said, look, Bill. So I thought to myself, I got to really come up with something to get away from this guy, you know. So I come in, I said, Bill, look, you know, you're a salesman like I am, and you know, I'm up here at this convention, and I've got a bunch of customers that I've got to go take out to lunch. About 20 of them, you know, 25. And I said, I'm not going to drink, you know. I'll come right back after lunch. Don't you worry about that. Well, Bill was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and he sort of dealt with us rum-dums before, you know. And he sort of grinned at me, you know, and he looked at me and he said, George, he said, that's real nice. He said, I'll tell you what you do. He said, you gather them all up, and we'll all go out to lunch. And he said, I'll pick up the tab, you know. Well, that sort of shot that out in the window, you know. So I said, okay, Bill, where do we go to get sober? You know? So I went up in his room and I shook that drunk out. And the next day he got me on the plane back. And I got back to my group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was October 26, 1966. And I got back in that group. But I was still, you know, the dishonesty and, you know, the alcoholic. Because I was, you know, still insisting I was going to meetings and all that. And God didn't say a word. And it was much later that, you know, I became honest and told God. And he knew it all the time. He said, my God, you called down here mumbling, jumbling, you know, in the blackout and all that stuff. But I'm grateful for that, you know. I'm grateful for the miracles. And there's all of us are miracles, you know. And sometimes I forget to dwell on how, you know, a drunk can come from Williamstown, West Virginia, 2,700 people, and be on a drunk and end up, and the only person that he talks to when he needs a drink is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that God had placed in his way. And he got sober and got back. And I started in on sobriety, and I started in with a sponsor who was a very good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and who was a big book member of Alcoholics Anonymous and who believed in the recovery that's written down in that book. And it's exactly the way he started teaching me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He started taking me to meetings, and he was not a person, you know. There, sometimes we pick up things from other places, and I'm not sure where we pick them up. But a lot of times today we hear 90 and 90, you know. It's sort of I don't know, that sort of upsets me because I'm not sure I could have done 90 and 90. Because the type of drunk I was, if I did 90, then I thought, well, it would be all over. You know, we've done our 90, so let's go home. And you know, what he did with me is he called me every day, and I called him every day, and he picked me up every day for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't set any time limits. You know, and we just kept going to meetings till I got, you know, it was months and months and months and months later, you know, there's just no break from it. You know, we're just going to meetings. I mean, it's sort of, that's what you did, you know. And I can remember one time sitting at my house, you know, and he called at 6 o'clock in the evening, and he interrupted my dinner, you know, which he did every night. And and was going to tell me what time he was going to pick me up to take me to a meeting, because we had a schedule that we went, you know, to various places, and sometimes it took longer to get to this meeting than it did to this meeting, so, you know, the time changed. So that's why he had to call me every day. And so my first wife came back to the table, and she said, it's Guy, and he wants to tell you what time he's going to pick up the meeting. And I said, well, you know, I really don't want to go to a meeting. I said, I'm getting tired of him calling over here. Now, I'm telling her this now. I said, I'm getting tired of him calling over here and interrupting my dinner. And she said, well, George, why don't you just simply tell him that? I said, darn if I'm going to tell him, you tell him. I'm scared of him, you know. But you know, he loved me sober. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I thought that if you would have given me $50,000, if you'd gotten my wife straightened out a little bit, you know, and told my mother that it's not the motherly thing to do to disown children, and, you know, that I'd been all right. But he didn't do that for me. He gave me something more valuable than that. He gave me time. He gave me his time. He carried me to meetings, and he talked to me, and he taught me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first place that he put me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started me on the doctor's opinion. You know, he used to say, and I also believe, you know, that a lot of times we bring newcomers in and we assume that they're on step one, or that they've taken step one, or just the fact that they walk into a meeting that they have taken step one. He didn't believe that way. He believed that there was a strong identification in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he believed that I had to know what my illness was. And he believed that I had, you know, to learn this through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what he did is he started me reading. And he started me reading the doctor's opinion. And he started talking about what Dr. Silkworth talked about us alcoholics. And you know, I was 27 years old when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And my thinking was, you know, I drank out on the streets with all these people who were real smart people. That's why they're still out there drinking. And they gave me my definition of alcoholism. You know, when I was drinking, they told me what an alcoholic was. And they kept changing it so I wouldn't have to be it. But what they told me was that alcoholics were old people, not young people. I mean real, real old. I mean, you know, as old as Al. I mean real, real old, you know. And they wore long overcoats, you know, in the middle of July. And, you know, they had these patent leather shoes where their feet would pat out the bottom, of, you know, and pat the cement. And they didn't have a wristwatch. I mean, we're talking about serious alcoholics here, you know. And I certainly didn't meet that criteria. You know, I had a wristwatch left. It was a beat-up Timex, but it was a wristwatch. Didn't keep time, but it was a wristwatch. I wasn't old. I was 27 years old. Felt old, looked old, but wasn't old, you know. And didn't own an overcoat. So I didn't wear one in February. So I didn't have to worry about July. And but you see, I used that. So I was not an alcoholic. Guy said that Dr. Silkworth didn't say anything about that. Dr. Silkworth didn't say anything about age. Dr. Silkworth didn't say anything about overcoats or how far you'd gone down or whatever. Dr. Silkworth said things like, you know, the alcoholic drinks because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I could identify with that. Dr. Silkworth talked about things like the phenomenon of craving. That once you pick up a drink of alcohol, you drink to oblivion. That you can't stop that craving. That it's a physical craving. Well, I certainly could identify with that. I did that from the time I was 13 years old. I did that from the time, very first time I ever picked up a drink of alcohol. And Dr. Silkworth told a lot of things about us alcoholics that made sense to me. Dr. Silkworth talks about the alcoholic who doesn't know the true from the false. That he thinks his life is the normal life. I certainly could relate to that. I thought my life was the normal life. I think it's very normal to get drunk and burn down your garage. Really. I think it's very normal to wreck 15, 20 cars. I think it's normal to go to jail in 8 states. That's normal. So I started relating to and understood what he was talking to me about my disease. And he also explained to me that Bill, when he wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, liked to speak in parables. And that if you look at his readings in the book, that when he wants to make a point and he makes a statement, he'll tell a story. And that's what he did with his story. That when I read Bill's story, that what I was actually reading is he was substantiating everything that Dr. Silkworth said in the doctor's opinion. But he told it in his experience. And so I started learning about alcoholism. And I started understanding why I was in, you know, why about my disease. Now, I wished I could tell you that at that point, that everything went wonderful. But I'm not the type of alcoholic that does things like that. You know, what I ended up at that point was being not a two-stepper. I've never really been good on fractions, but I was some sort of fractional stepper. And I'd like to explain that, because what I did was I took the first half of step one. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. And then I jumped all the way to one-third of step 12. I carried the message to other alcoholics. And guy used to say, "You're not carrying the message, you're carrying the mess." And you're the mess. But, you know, Dr. Silkworth, when he started explaining alcoholism to me, and Guy started explaining alcoholism to me, you know, he related alcoholism as a threefold illness. He related the alcoholism as being a physical, mental, and spiritual illness. And you see, I was bankrupt in all three areas in those in my life. And what I would like, you know, the way I like to identify you, where I was with my alcoholism is where I was in those three areas of my life when I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. And physically, it's not too hard to explain to you. Physically, I weighed 254 pounds. I was bloated, bleary-eyed. I'd never been in a detox center. I was afraid of the jitter joints. You know, I used to sort of walk drunks off. And I lived in a small town, which, by the way, you know, has the prophecy, you know, in the vision for you has been fulfilled there, because Bill said that there'll be AA groups in every little hamlet and city. And that little hamlet of 2,700 people has an AA group, very fine AA group, matter of fact, the Williamstown Serenity Group. But they didn't at that time. But they had a little country doctor by the name of Dr. Bateman that I drove crazy. I used to go to Dr. Bateman, you know, and I was the type of alcoholic. I have to explain this to you. I know a lot of people heard me talk about it, but it's very important to me. Because some of us get it after we're sober. But I got it when I was drunk. But I was that type of alcoholic that couldn't watch Ben Casey on television. There's just no way that I could do that because I got every disease. You know, if I watched it on Tuesday night or whenever it came on Wednesday, I had whatever they were talking about. And it didn't make any difference whether you could catch it in this country or not. I had it, you know. And I've had every disease known to man. I've had malaria and elephantitis and was pregnant twice. And I mean, it's funny now to talk about it, but it was horrible back then. I mean, and this little doctor, and I think it's sad in a sense, because this doctor was a very fine doctor, probably a very educated doctor. And he told me after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and after a while, and I started taking drunks to him, you know, for physical problems or whatever. And he told me, he said, George, I knew that you were an alcoholic. He said, but I was afraid to tell you because you were young. See, I think that's sad, but anyway. This little doctor, and I don't know how many of you, there's some people here from Williamstown, so they certainly know what I'm talking about. And some of you from small towns know what I'm talking about. But in a small town, and with one doctor, what happens in a small town is that you go over and get in line. Whoever gets there first in the morning is seen first. And we don't take appointments, they just see you as they come. And little Doc Bateman, he had all the machines in his office. Now, I had a very, very serious problem, not only with Ben Casey, but I had a long history of heart disease. Had heart attacks from early age on. So I'd go to Doc Bateman. You know, I'd get into one of these drunks, and all of a sudden, you know, the heart would start acting up. And so I'd go over there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd say, Doc, you know, I think this is really the one that's going to get me. You know, I've had it. And he'd put me on the EKG machine, and he'd run all these tests, and he'd say, George, your heart's fine, going out, so I'd go out. Well, I did this one time for about 14 days, and every morning, over, in line, you know, whatever. And you who are salesmen might identify with this, but the 15th day, I was out into my territory, about 45 miles away from home, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I hadn't had a drink yet, and I was sitting in a man's office trying to sell him some product, and all of a sudden, I mean the big one hit. You know, the one that Red Fox talked about, you know, and I mean, on Sanford and Son. You know, I mean, the big one. And I knew this was it, you know. And I looked across to the guy I was trying to sell product to, and by the way, I never sold him any more product after this, but I said, you know, you're going to have to excuse me, because I'm dying right here. Probably as we talk. And he, of course, you know, all those normal people, they really don't know what to do with us alcoholics. And then he said, oh, yeah, that's fine, George, please go. I mean, I have no problem. I have no problem with you leaving. Go on ahead. And so I went home to die. But I thought by chance that if they could save me, you know, that it would be nice. And so I called, you know, going down the road, I called my first wife, and I said, you know, make arrangements at the hospital because I'm coming home to die, but they might be able to save me, you know. And so I went over to the Marietta Hospital and checked in. And make a long story short, they ended up testing me, and they decided what I really had was hypertension, and I was overworked. Now, let me explain something to you at this point. I'm not a very intelligent person, and I really don't know what hypertension is today. I mean, I don't understand what that was, other than the fact he sort of added on the end of it that it might be nice if I took a few drinks in the evening, you know, which I thought went over real well with the first wife. But you see, my alcoholic father, I had worked for their company, and he was my boss, and he and I fought all the time. And I never really listened to anything he ever said, except one thing. And this might explain to you about the old work. He used to say to me, he said, George, you know, we have an image out there, and we have customers, and he said, when you take a drink, he said, I want you to quit working for that day. You know, whenever it is you take a drink, don't work anymore. Well, I listened to that. I mean, I think it was really important that I respect that. So once I took a drink, I didn't work. So you can tell by that I wasn't overworked, because I drank all the time. So physically, you know, that's where I was, and mentally I was in the same shape when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had reached the point mentally that we talk about the fear, and we talk about walking around all the time and just in this total fear, and alcohol had just, you know, I reached the point where when I'd get down, you know, I'd be in the house, and if that little wife, she was 115 pounds, soaking wet, and if she wasn't there to protect me from them, and we all know who them are. I mean, I can't give you a name, but we know they're out there. Somewhere. To protect me, if she wasn't there to protect me from them, then I had to have all the lights on in the house. And I had to have a butcher knife by the bed, and I had to have a gun by the bed, and I had to have the radio on, and I had to have the television on, and I'd peek out the curtains, and I wouldn't answer the door, and I wouldn't answer the telephone, and just total fear. Just scared absolutely to death. Only went out at night. You know, I sort of identify with Bill when he talks about the children of the night. And so, mentally, that's where I was. Spiritually, real quick where I was, I was raised in a fundamentalist church down in West Virginia, as probably a lot of places that have these type churches, and I'm not making fun of these churches at all, but it's just the way it was. They're very serious about their religion. And the church that I grew up in was one of those churches that if they did not build that church by a river or a stream where they could dunk you, they were going to build something in the church where they could dunk you. Because they did not believe in sprinkling. They did not believe in, you know, passing things over the top of your head or whatever. They believed in dunking. And when I was 12 years old, they dunked me. They baptized me, put a little white washcloth over my face, and they dunked me down in this tank. And I still resent the minister, you know, the preacher, a little bit, because I think he held me down a little too long. Right? I came up spluttering and all that, and I walked out of that church. And I never walked back in a church until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started eroding from that point on and through my alcoholism with my spirituality. And I ended up walking in Alcoholics Anonymous and agnostic. And that's why I jumped over those steps. You know, I wasn't about to hear the spiritual recovery. I had a real problem with that. And when I came to that chapter, and when you started talking about the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous was a spiritual recovery, Guy explained to me that that chapter said, we agnostics. Because, see, I was holding on to being an agnostic as being different. Like a lot of people use other things today as being different. And I kept saying, but you don't understand. I'm different. And he says, you know, that chapter says we agnostics. It does not say George the agnostic or George and only one other agnostic. It says we agnostics. He said, so that must mean that somewhere in the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some people just like you. He also looked at me, you know, and he said, George, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous gives us a definition of our disease, and it gives us a solution, and it tells us how that we can recover. But you see, I wasn't buying that. I really wasn't. And I went a year and a half being a fractional stepper or whatever I was, And after a year and a half, and I like, this is why I like to talk about this, because, you know, there might be someone sitting here tonight, there might be someone sitting in your home group that's rejecting what we have here. And I got in a sicker condition than I ever got in my life after a year and a half sober. You know, and I told you about kidding about being a suicidal alcoholic and whatever. And I'm not putting down suicide, because alcoholics commit suicide. But it's only been my experience that the alcoholics that I've known that commit suicide from a dry period, not a wet period. You see, somehow I could muddle through the drinking, but I couldn't muddle through the sobriety. What I had a problem with was living sober. You know, the worst times in my life, I look back, and the worst times in my life drinking, or the period before Alcoholics Anonymous, was not the drinking. I mean, those were horrible. A lot of things happened and whatever. But the worst times were the few days that I white-knuckled sobriety, had nothing to replace it. All I do was, for some reason, I couldn't drink. And I hated people that drank, and I hated being where I was, and I just could not handle living sober. And that lesson came to me after a year and a half sober. I came to a point in my life that I could not go on any longer. And I seriously, seriously contemplated suicide. But fortunately, I went to an old man in Marietta, Ohio, by the name of Glenn Benedict. He's dead now, and Glenn was a beautiful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a very quiet, unassuming man, and walked in this program with dignity, and it just was a beautiful person. And I went to Glenn, and I said, Glenn, I think I'd be better off drunk than the way I am right now. And thank God what he told me was the truth. You know, there's been a lot of years in my sobriety or whatever. I was the type of person that would tell you what you want to hear instead of what you know. I mean, I didn't want to, you know, hurt your feelings. And I didn't, you know, I would soft pedal maybe. Thank God Glenn didn't do that to me. Glenn looked me dead in the eyes and told me the truth. He said, George, you're right. You would be better off drunk than the way you are right now. But he followed that up with that, you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they've laid out a plan of sobriety. And there is an answer for this if you will work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time in my life, I think I got honest. I said, Glenn, I don't understand the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know what you're all talking about when you talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, George, I'll walk you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this dear man did exactly that. He started working with me within the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He started working with me on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He started working with me so that I could live joyous, happy, and free. He started working with me through the steps that are outlined in that book. And he started on step one, and he explained to me what I was doing with step one. The reason I was taking one half of step one. He said, you know, he said, that step does not say that I'm powerless over alcohol and that if I quit drinking alcohol, my life will become managed. That it does not say, it says alcoholism is a disease. It doesn't say alcohol is your problem. He said, if alcohol is your problem, just don't drink alcohol and your life will be fine. It says that you admit you're powerless over alcohol, hyphen, which means there's a separate thought coming, that your life has become unmanageable. And when I took the step in that way, I was able to take the next 11 steps. If I stopped with just the powerlessness over alcohol, that's where I stopped with my life. And that's all I would be dealing with, is not drinking alcohol. And so I took that step, but then it brought this agnostic to a point that he was at the solution. And it said, came to believe the power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And you know, I don't know about you alcoholics, but as an alcoholic myself, you know, I have a real problem with a couple words in step two. I have a real problem with insanity. I mean, you know, you can take, well, not really. I love her very, very much. But you can almost take Marie, you know, and you can beat on my kids and you can do whatever you want to. But don't you call me crazy. You know, we alcoholics don't deal with that real well. I also read into that step, came to faith. I didn't think it said came to believe. I was one of those that thought, well, if you take step two, then all of a sudden you're wonderful. I mean, you're a believer. And you know, this man was the one that explained to me, you know, that what happened to me is that when I went to the churches, which I did, and I'm not knocking churches. I think churches are very good, and I think some alcoholics get sober in church. And please don't think I'm doing that. I'm talking about my relation to it. And when I went to the churches or I went to various places, they kept telling me to change my thinking. And my actions would change. And I can't do that. I don't know about you all. I can't do that. AA related to me the other way around. What Glenn told me was that you change your actions and your thinking will change. And so I started acting my way into a spiritual awakening. I started acting on a belief that I knew that Guy and Glenn were believers. I knew that they believed in God. I knew that they believed in something. And all they told me to do was to ask for help and to ask on their belief. Now, I subscribe to what Chick's friend says down in Little Rock. And I believe that very, very much. Because Charlie talks about, or Joe talks about, that you believe in something first and you take action on that belief and you get results from that action and then you have faith. And you see, Glenn also explained to me that the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that God could and would if he were sought. It did not say God could and would if he were found. And you see, that's what I was trying to do. Find God. He says it's in the seeking that we find him. It's in the action. Seeking is an action word. And so when we started talking about the insanity, all of a sudden, you know, as an alcoholic, I had a real problem with that. Somebody's saying, trying to say to me that I'm crazy, you know. Well, I'll tell you something. Dr. Silkworth talks about a mental obsession. A mental obsession is insanity. You know, if I said to you tonight that I used to take toilet paper and hide it all over my house, and that I took toilet paper with me everywhere I went, and I couldn't go to the movies without toilet paper, and that I lied about the use of toilet paper, and if I got stopped by a cop, I only admitted to taking two sheets, that you would say to me, "You're crazy." Well, I got news for you. I did the same thing with alcohol. I didn't do it with toilet paper. I did it with alcohol. I obsessed it. And so that to me is insanity. Doesn't mean we may not be crazy in other areas. I happen to be crazy in other areas, but some of us aren't, you know. So I started relating and understood what he was talking about in step two. And then I got to the point where Glenn had came to me, you know, I came to Glenn and I said, "Glenn, you know, I now have a belief in a higher power, in a God of my understanding." And he said, "Now we want to take step three." And he said, "Well, really what we're going to do is to take the first step to recovery." He said, "We're going to take step three." And see, I was an alcoholic that looked at step three as a perfection step. I thought once we took step three, that you would probably come up and kiss the hem of my garment and whatever. Because that we were going to be wonderful from this point on. But Glenn explained that that's not what it says. It says it's a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understood it. And that's all I was to do. Still my life. It was still my will. I turn it over to the care and protection of God. I could relate to the step that way. But he also explained to me, after we took the step on our knees, like it's suggested in the book, Glenn and I took that step together. He read to me right after the step where it says that this will have very little effect unless it's followed by a course of action. And that course of action are 4 through 12. And I started working the steps that offer to me the solution, that offers to me a way to find a spiritual way of life. And I started with steps that were preparation steps and action steps. I started preparing. I took a fourth step, which was a preparation step. I started preparing to clear away the wreckage of my past by putting down on paper, as the book talked about, three lists, resentments, fear, and sex, and analyzed them and looked at my life and got out my character defects and then went and took an action with another human being and admitted to that person and God and myself the exact nature of my wrong. And after that point, Glenn told me to go home, look at the first five proposals, and prepare in step six to become entirely ready to have God remove these character defects. And when I was ready, to humbly ask him and take that action to remove those. And then when I was through with that, I would prepare again a list of people that I had harmed in looking forward to taking an action in step nine of making direct amends to these people. And so what I did then was put down a list of people that a lot of them were on my resentment list in my fourth step. And I started putting down a list of people that I'd harmed. Now at this point, I'm still a pretty sick alcoholic, and I was putting people down like bar rooms that I had knocked doors down and stuff like this. And Glenn said, you are a real sick person. He said, we're talking about a list and we're talking about harm. And he explained to me the difference between hurt and harm. He said, George, you know, harm is more than hurt. Harm is lasting. Harm can be physical or it can be mental, but it's lasting. And he said, we're not talking about doors that you broke down in bar rooms. We're talking about hearts that you broke in families. And we're talking about close friends. And we're talking about employers. And we're talking about people that you have harmed. And I put that list down, and in step nine, I took and went out and took that list and went out and made amends to those people. And that was the action that I had to take to clear away the wreckage of my past. I came from Charleston, West Virginia down there, and I'll tell you, if you want to know what freedom is, I don't know about any other alcoholic, but when I could walk down the streets of Charleston, West Virginia, and not duck down alleys, because I saw someone that I really didn't want to see, that is one hell of a freedom. To be able to look the world in the eye and be able to live as one of God's people, like I think that he wants us to live, without any of the guilt and remorse and the things that just eat us alcoholics alive, is a real freedom. And then when I got to step 10, Glenn explained to me that 10 tells me that the word continued says it's something I've done before. So what I do is I continue to take 4 and 5. I continue to prepare and take actions. And I started working on 10, and I started working on 11, and 11 told me that I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying for only the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And for years, I missed the last part of that step. For years, as self-centered alcoholic as I was always looking for what His will for me was. What it says, and what I need very, very much, and one of the things that is very important to me today, to be in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous like this, is that I feel God's power, and I get God's power in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a friend of mine back in Charleston. Hal probably knows him. that claims that God is an alcoholic. And the reason he says God's an alcoholic is it because he feels the presence of God at every Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that he ever attends, even closed meetings. And we all know that you have to be an alcoholic to be in closed meetings. But I do seek out the power. I do seek out the power, and this is where I find the power. And then I came to step 12, and step 12 explains itself. To me, it's such a beautiful step because it says that we have a spiritual awakening. You know, we talk about the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. How about the promise in step 12? It says, if I'll take these 11 steps, I'll have a spiritual awakening. And as I carry this message to alcoholics, it doesn't say anything about drinking alcoholics or dry alcoholics or anything else. It says alcoholics. You see, I certainly was a dry alcoholic when Glenn carried that message to me. You know, I was in a lot of pain. I wasn't a newcomer to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was a newcomer to the concept that there is a spiritual recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he carried that message to me. And we try to practice these principles in all our affairs. And you know, to me it means all of our affairs. You know, I don't know that any of us. And I certainly am not perfect, and I don't want to come across as being unperfect. There's a lot of people here that will tell you and know that I'm not perfect. Bill said it himself. You know, Bill, who really likes to explain a lot of things in the book and is very impressed with his, you know, knowledge of how he can explain things, made one statement in the book that explains me. And he didn't really embellish it. All he said was, we are not saints. Period. Didn't go on to explain anything about it. So I understand that, and I believe that, and I believe that we progress, you know, in this program. And so when he talks about practices, principles, and all affairs, what it means to me is the principles that are interweaved into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about the principles of honesty, and it talks about the principles of humility, and it talks about all the principles that are in those steps that I should carry into my daily life. And I try to do that. And I'm at a point now where I need to really close. And there's a lot of people who've heard this story, but I need to tell this story for me. And I hope I don't bore you, some of you, with it, because it is important for me. When I was 5 or 6 years sober, I moved to Charleston, back to my hometown, and got involved with a person that a lot of people, Bob certainly, and Joan, know him. And he was a barber, and his name was Pete. And I sponsored Pete. And Pete was what a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous called losers. Or he called them a loser, because Pete was one of those, and I'm sure groups have them, that he would get 12 months of sobriety, and he'd go out and drink, and he'd come back, and he'd get 10 months of sobriety, and he'd go out and drink and whatever. And I too was calling him a loser. And I was at a point in, you know, in my AA life that I was very spiritually arrogant and had all the answers. And, you know, I don't know if you go through that, but, you know, I went through everything that I think you can go through in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Pete ended up, I sponsored him for about 12 or 13 months, and he went out and he came down to North Carolina and he took a drink of alcohol for the last time, and his liver burst and he died, age 43. And there's a lot of us alcoholics that do die. You know, I think some of us here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know myself, at times I'll get a little smug and say, you know, here we are in our little wonderful little world, but we are such a minority. You know, we who trudge this path of this beautiful fellowship are such a minority. And sometimes I forget to be grateful for that, because there are so many alcoholics out there that are like Pete. They die. You know, and the majority of alcoholics are not in these rooms. The majority of alcoholics are out there. And anyway, Pete died, and they brought him back to West Virginia to bury him, and he was at the funeral home, and And I went down to the funeral home to see Barbara, his wife, and standing in the funeral home at this time that I went down to see Barbara, his wife, was a tall, sort of a tall man, and he had rosy cheeks, and he was dressed up, and he looked real good, you know, and he looked real familiar to me, but I didn't say anything to him, you know. And the next night I went back to the funeral home, and I walked in, and here he is again. He's back again, and he's still looking good, and it sort of bothered me because he looked so familiar. I walked over to him and I said, do I know you? And he said, yeah, you should know me. He said, he said, 3.5 years ago, my sponsor and you came out and 12-stepped me. He lived out in the country. And he said, I haven't had a drink since then. And he said, my wife and family are back with me, and I hold a job, and I live life to the fullest, and I feel good. And he said, I'm grateful for that. And you know, I thought, boy, this is horrible, because I still couldn't remember who he was, even though I'd made a 12-step call. And so I looked at him trying to grasp for answers, and I said, who is your sponsor? And he said, you're looking at him in the casket. He said, Pete's my sponsor. Now I'll tell you that from that moment on, Pete was not a loser. From that moment on, I realized that Pete had done something that Mr. Arrogant, spiritually arrogant alcoholic who'd gotten into that rut was not doing. He was carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. In his sobriety, in his short periods of sobriety, he had carried this man to meetings. He had spent the time that Guy had spent with me, with this man. And he was spoon-feeding him Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was carrying this message. And to this man who was looking down at him, looking at Pete, who I was calling a loser, you wouldn't dare call a loser to him. Because to him, he was his sponsor. And he was grateful. It's important for me to remember that. It's important for me to remember that winners in Alcoholics Anonymous are losers who keep trying. And you know, Pete was not a loser. And I hope tonight that I've only done about 5% of the job of carrying the message to you that Pete did to carry into that drunk. Thank you. I love you all very, very much. And it's been a great trip, George and Joe. Thank you.